Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. During this podcast, I sit down with Connor Jensen, who is VP of Data Science for Americas at Data IQ.
Howdy, how are you, Ben?
Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. It's the morning's started in force, so this should be a good day.
Yeah, it's the morning where you are, isn't it? What time is
yeah.
it?
Yeah, 9. I'm in Chicago. Wow. So.
Oh God, I don't know if I could do a podcast at 9 in the morning. My brain just does not start that quickly.
I'm a morning person, so it's like if you wanted to do this at like 6 p.m., useless.
No chance.
No. But like by 11, all my best work is done for the day. So
nice. I'm very envious of the way you work. That is so not me at all.
So I was in the military for like 6 years, and I worked at Starbucks for 10 years.
Wow,
so between the two of those, I was at work by 7 or 5 for about, 15 years. So I used to start work at 4:30 every morning. I did that my whole way through university. So I was up at 3:30, at work by 4:30 every day. So 7, 8, 9, this is nothing.
Yeah, this is late for you, if anything.
It's a learned behavior or a learned skill, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's just come over time, hasn't it? It's slowly ingrained into your yep. routine. Yeah, cool. But I think sometimes in the morning, if you have like a meeting first thing in the morning, it can like fire your brain up.
Yes. And that's where the challenge is always, and this is my first meeting this morning was a contentious one, right?
Right.
So like that's definitely at 8 a.m. I'm not quite ready to pick fights yet. And I'm definitely not as diplomatic as I probably should be. So there's definitely like, there's a curve on it. It's like, I'm ready to start working at 8. I'm not quite ready for the certain types of meetings at 8. But yeah, like, but I'm definitely awake now. There's no denying that.
Yeah, I find coffee massively enhances my mood. I don't think I could do any, I genuinely don't think I could do anything without causing any offense before I've had a cup of coffee.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm actually on tea today.
Nice.
I try like 1 month a year to give up coffee because otherwise, the amount that you drink just keeps climbing and climbing and climbing.
It does.
So I'm thinking April is a wash because I've been drinking tea all month and I'm pretty sure I've been not 100% on my game.
You know, I heard a story about Dave Grohl, the guitarist from Foo Fighters. Apparently, there was one time when he was in the studio and he went to the hospital because he thought he was having a heart attack. But it's just because he had 40 cups of coffee in one day. 40 cups of coffee.
I believe it. I totally believe it. It's the thing that I used to laugh about at Starbucks. So, start working at 4:30 in the morning. So you show up and, like you're setting up the store. So, you throw something over, throw some ice, throw some espresso in a cup, have that, finish that one, open the doors, have another one. By the time 7 o'clock rolls around, you're outside having a cigarette.
Yeah.
You're on your fourth thing of coffee and you realize 7 a.m. and I've had 16 shots of espresso.
No.
Yeah, a regular basis.
Wow. I'm surprised you're still alive.
I am too. I've taken at least like 20 years off the end of my life, right? Like there's no way, right? Between putting myself through school, a decade at Starbucks in the military where, you pretty much survived on like cigarettes, beer and alcohol or cigarettes, beer and coffee, right? Like any given point in time consuming 1, 2 or all 3. my 20s, I don't remember much of my 20s because I didn't sleep much and I was very, very caffeinated. So...
Right, you mentioned that you worked at Starbucks for a long time. And also, I've done a lot of digging, Connor. I've done a bit of research on you. I hope you don't mind.
Good.
And I found some particularly interesting things.
Okay. I like that. I like where we're going.
And you're a weather forecaster in the Air Force as well. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's if there's anything that's sort of like my like start in analytics, such as it was after I dropped out of college, I enlisted in the Air Force here in the States and became a weather forecaster and spent 3 years on active duty using weather models to figure out what was going on. And so that was very much my start from the analytics world, was sort of like not as a creator of analytics, but as a consumer arguably maybe the most advanced data science products that exist today. I think weather models, it's arguable, right? Maybe it's not the most advanced, but you could make the case.
Yeah. And also you're an emergency management technician in the Air National Guard. Is that right too?
Yeah. So when I got off of active duty, I went back to school full time and stayed in the National Guard. And so there, the emergency management stuff was really interesting because in the National Guard in the U.S., right, you have a wartime and a peacetime job. So our wartime job was chemical defense. And so we taught people how to use gas masks and we used all the detectors when there was, you know, like a potential attack. And then on the civilian side, we were all hazmat technicians. And so then we got trained, we worked with the fire team. We were all certified as hazmat responders and stuff. And it was a very different side of like the risk world than, you know, when I then later was in insurance, where then I was sort of like the risk as abstract versus like risk as in something is on fire and we think there's chemicals, go put on your suit and figure it out. Very different sort of like lifestyle there in terms of dealing with risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious to find out, you know, how, because you studied mathematics at university or college, mm-hmm. as you would call it across the pond.
Sure.
So then was that a smooth transition into, I mean, I don't know how much, does maths have a lot to do with this kind of thing or not much?
Not
or?
At all. it's a good question. So when I went back, I went back to school at 26 or 27, right? After I'd gotten out of active duty in the military. And I've always been good at maths, right? So like, you know, it was sort of wanted to go into something quantitative, was debating, you know, do I do science or do I do, you know, and I sort of was like, didn't really know what I wanted to do, right? I'd been working at Starbucks. I'd been a forecaster. I was in the Guard. I had like no idea what I sort of wanted to be when I grew up. Of course, I'm, you know, 26, 27, married with two kids and still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. And so I just did math, like, honestly, just because I was like, I like math. I'm good at it. I'll just major in that. And like, no real notion of what was going to come after that. So smooth transition. No, it was definitely like a hard left on that. But I guess the piece that I can say that like where it did make a little bit of sense, you know, as a forecaster, doing the forecasting stuff was really, really interesting. And honestly, learning about weather and like thinking about, you know, how do you think about like weather systems and dealing with models and like was extremely analytical and really fun. But again, we were all sort of like downstream. And the downside of being a forecaster is that, you know, weather doesn't stop. And so, and you're sitting there at 3 a.m. on a Saturday and the guy across from you has been doing this for 23 years and he's sitting there at 3 a.m. on a Saturday. Wow. I'm like, okay, this is not the part of this world that I want to be in.
Yeah.
And so the notion of like, okay, this is fun. I had more fun learning about this stuff than I really do maybe on a day-to-day basis doing it. How do I get upstream in this sort of like this process? That's about as much rational thought as went into it. But yes, it was definitely a big shift.
Yeah. And then now you're VP of data science at, my silly British accent is going to really struggle with this name. Dataiku.
Yeah, that works. There's a lot of pronunciations of it. It's so I pronounce it Dataiku. The way that it's described is it's a combination, it's a portmanteau of data and haiku, the Japanese poems.
Okay.
But of course, you know, it's a French company, and so they say data and haiku, and so they say
Dataiku. I like that one.
So there's a very like we're such a global company, and it's such a weird word that there's, you know, whatever 600-700 people that work here. Yeah. There's probably 599 to 699 pronunciations of it, let alone all of our customers. So the way you said it is very much within the range of pronunciations that I hear.
Okay, well, that's fine then. That's all good. So I just want to find out what that is as a business and what products you provide there.
So Dataiku, our primary product is a data science development platform. It's called Data Science Studio, DSS. As a still relatively young startup, right, we're 7, almost 8 years old, it's still sort of the one product. And so I'd say our customers and internally sort of we use the term DSS and Dataiku somewhat interchangeably still today. But the whole point of DSS is a platform for companies to develop data science products themselves and to make that easier than what we think any of the other options out there are, right? Okay. So it's not a drop-in application. It's not we build algorithms for you and sell you the algorithms. You know, we're selling companies the capability to build data science products themselves. A big piece of how it's different than I think other platforms out there is that it's explicitly built to be for sort of the whole analytics lifecycle and all of the people that are involved in doing that, or most. All is a big term, so we'll say most. But if you think about sort of data science and building a product, you know, end to end, starting with your engineering, your data engineering side of things, you know, the pulling out, structuring, cleaning data. Some of that's happening from your data engineering team. Some of that's happening in data scientists. You actually have then the model development phase of it, which is data scientists, analysts, business users, all sort of interacting to say, hey, what's the problem we're trying to solve? Does this model fit it? And then there's the downstream side of actually the ML ops and pushing things out to production. And so the platform has both GUI elements for those sort of like lower technical analyst users, as well as coding capabilities for your data engineers, for your data scientists that have like proper coding skills. And then on the implementation side is as automated as possible, both in terms of like sort of automating batch sort of stuff and running like full production cycles, or generating APIs where we want to make it data scientists. Not many data scientists are like real software engineers and should be building production code. Yeah. I certainly should not be building production code. So I will own that myself. And so we really try to abstract some of that what the MLOps side of things looks like, and making it so that you can take what you built and push it out. And so again, right? So it's this sort of like end to end, from getting data out of your source systems to putting a model in the hands of your users. Who needs to do it and what are the tools? And we really try to pull all of that to the center.
Wow. There's a point you mentioned MLOps, and I don't know too much about MLOps, so I'd really want to find out a little bit about what that is. I mean, is it a relatively new thing that's come out?
So it's I'd say MLOps is a term, is definitely the last couple of years kind of become more popularized. You know, when I sort of started in this state, so, you know, I have been in what I'd say we properly call data science right now for about 8-9 years now, started in the like early 2010s, about 2013, 2014, in building a data science team at a large insurance company, and was trying to take, you know, all these newfangled open source data science things that we were hearing about and bring them in and you know, change the way we built models as a company, where we are, you know, we had actuaries, we had predictive modelers, we'd been doing it for a long time and really trying to modernize that. The biggest challenge as we really dug on into how do we do this both with newer tools, but also faster, was the production, right? And so, you know, we didn't have a word, we didn't have the MLOps word for it, you know, then, but that we called it productionalization or operationalization or, you know, whatever gigantic, you know, word you wanted to use for it. But it was after you've built a model, how do you get that into the hands of the users? That to me is the core piece of MLOps. I think it's expanded over time to include some of the notions of governance, retraining, redistribution, things like champion and challenger, all of that sort of stuff around saying, like, once a model's been built, how are we putting it out into the hands of the users in a streamlined fashion? How are we monitoring how it's performing? And how are we swapping it out when it needs to be updated, right? That whole side of things that's very much, you know, I sort of like IT land, you know, to a data scientist more or less, or where data scientists often ended up owning it and spent more time maintaining models that they'd built than building new ones. That to me is MLOps, is like, you know, almost, it's not everything that happens once you've built that model, but it's a lot of it.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks for that. That's cleared up a lot of questions in my head.
Sure.
I'm interested in about how you kind of stay ahead of the curve, because I mean, this kind of industry, in this industry, everything is changing all the time. So what resources do you like rely on? What are your go-to resources to keep you in the loop, I guess?
So, you know, it's a good question. You know, from a company perspective, I personally rely on probably like two big pieces. One, we have, as part of our R&D team, which, and of course, R&D for us is an engineering team. You know, most of them are software engineers first. Some of them do have, you know, like mathematical computer science or, you know, like, you know, more data science-y, but they're all engineers. But within that team, there is a team of a handful of just R&D data scientists. And that's their whole purpose, is just researching, seeing what's coming out there, how are, you know, our customers looking at using. And so that's a big piece for me of, you know, like we have that sort of like internal team that they're not building product, they're not working on my customers, they're just there to do that. And so the things that they're working on and that they're sort of communicating to the rest of us is a good piece. The second one for me, right, you know, and I'm lucky in, you know, working with a team of, you know, there's almost 20 people here in the States that report to me. There's nearly 30 people in Europe that are data scientists reporting to one of my colleagues there. And they're talking to customers every day. And that's more than anything what really where, you know, my own sort of personal like drive in data science comes from is what is actually happening on the ground. And so that's the piece that like becomes a tricky part for us is sort of like hearing what customers are working on and staying abreast or ahead of them as much as possible. Having a platform that can be used by any different industry and any different function means that, you know, obviously I know, you know, 1% of what, you know, the sort of my customers know cumulatively, but just seeing the patterns, seeing the types of use cases that they're doing, seeing the technology things that they're bringing to the table. And it happens on a pretty regular basis where, you know, I hop on and the customer's like, well, how do we integrate this technology? And I'm like, haven't heard of that. So let me go find out. Right. So it's a game of sort of just trying to keep up with where things are going. But that was honestly the big push for me to go from being in industry to being in tech was, you know, I know I spent nearly a decade in insurance. I know the use cases. I know the data. I know the patterns. It was a great learning experience for me, but it was very much, you know, do I want to do this for the rest of my career or do I want to see what happens wider? And so it's why I came to tech deliberately was I want to see what manufacturing is doing, retail is doing, financial services, life sciences. I want to see what people analytics looks like, what, you know, marketing analytics. And so like that's, you know, again, right? Am I out ahead of my customers in most, right? Unless they're doing meteorology or insurance, I probably don't know more than the customer. But just trying to keep up with them presents me with like far more to learn than I ever could learn, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, are you the type of person that, I mean, is your personality very much a wanting to keep learning? I've found with...
Absolutely.
I've found with a lot of the people that's come on the show, it seems to be like a common thread that everyone has where they always strive to learn more and they kind of like get a buzz from that there's always something to learn.
I you know, when I'm hiring for data scientists or people in this field in general, so even in some, you know, our other teams around data science here that are supporting customers, the single most important characteristic for me is like really curiosity or that desire to learn. And I think that in data science to be successful, my opinion is that you have to have that because data science is moving and changing so fast, right? You know, I can certainly look at, you know, in principle, the things that I thought were important to do, you know, a decade ago when I were getting into this are still mostly the things that I think are the right sort of things to do when you're talking at, you know, 25,000, 50, 100,000 feet. But when you're talking the day-to-day, right? You know, so we were building on-prem Hadoop installations, you know, so 8-9 years, right? Nobody should have been building them then either, but we didn't know that. But, you know, nobody should be building Hadoop on-premise as your first thing. Yeah. There are valid reasons to build Hadoop or GPU or stuff on-premise today, but that's choice number like 4, right? After, you know, cloud or like other ideas. And so, you know, again, some of the specifics of what we thought were important to do back then, I don't think were right. And we learned that the hard way, but you know, the principles I think make sense, but the, you know, the technology, the tools, you know, so back then Transformer didn't exist. BERT didn't exist. You know, all the face stuff, the new NLP stuff there or computer vision, right? Like nobody was doing streaming video, you know, like, so like the specifics changed so fast that, you know, for me, I think you see, and you can see like the breadth or the depth, right? And you kind of see that in, you know, there's room for both of those, right? So there is sort of the classic academia trained data scientist with the PhD from, you know, the Bay Area or whatever that is super deep in NLP or in predictive analytics or in, you know, whatever specific piece, you know, is their thing. And to continue driving there, like, you know, those spaces all individually move and grow so fast that you have to have people that have that like real depth in specific areas. And then for me, there's also how widely it's spreading, right? So, you know, just the variety of use cases, computer generation, you know, computer vision, NLP, predictive analytics, you know, AI automation, like all of these huge variety, that's what drives me more is sort of like continuing to see like now, how are we taking what we learned about doing digital marketing analytics, where we had a crap ton of data, you know, 15, 20 years ago that really drove a lot of the starts in data science. how are we applying that to people analytics, right? Like, what did we learn there that we can do over here? What did I learn in financial services that I can use, you know, in retail? Or what did I learn in meteorology that I can? And so, like, for me, I'm often driven more by the breadth, but, you know, either way, that sort of curiosity and that desire to learn, that like, there's a lot of other things that can go into, and there's a lot of different ways to be a good data scientist. But I agree with you that if you're not driven to learn, the space is going to leave you behind.
Yeah. And it's almost like if you stay still, you're almost falling behind just by staying still.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're not moving forward, you're falling behind.
It was an interesting challenge for me sometimes in doing, trying to introduce data science in some sort of like, it's not legacy, isn't quite the right, but sort of an established industry where you didn't start with data science. You're not a tech company. You know, you don't have it as that core. Becoming more analytics and data driven is a shift for all those different industries, because they've already good at something. They're good at manufacturing, or they're good at customer, or whatever. So this is a shift. And one of the things that I really saw and was always a challenge was, you know, you had people who'd been doing analytics for 20 years or 30 years, and they used SAS, or they used SPS, or they used something else. And we bring in and say, hey, well, we're going to use, you know, we want to introduce Python because there's new capabilities that we're trying to bring in. And they say, but I already know SAS. And like that mindset of like, I already know this, so I don't want to learn something else, always like kind of flabbergasted me. Because yeah. I was like, what do you mean? This is, I'm a terrible coder. I'm always happy to own that, but I've learned to program in like 12 different languages over the course of my career. Wow. And I'm equally terrible in all of them, right? So like, I shouldn't be writing, but you know, 20 years ago, I was learning, you know, Visual Studio or whatever. And now, you know, I'm learning Visual Basic, and now, you know, I'm coding in Julia, right? And like, there's been a lot of different pieces along that way. And I learn enough to do my job and to know what my customers are doing. But, you know, every time there's a new chance, I'm like, ooh, how can I do this in Julia instead of Python? Yeah. Right? Like that's more interesting to me. And again, I spend like, you know, such a small amount of coding. It's a, you know, throwaway example in this, where I spend my time. But like that sort of idea of like, well, I know SAS, so I don't want to learn Python, is just foreign to me.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
And yeah, it's never really to me. I haven't seen the people that have that attitude be really successful in the long run.
Yeah, that would be a huge red flag if you saw that in an interview, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, do you think when you're hiring, would you say that the type of people that you look for would be, you know, would you say it's more beneficial to be generalists or specialists in one particular thing?
It really depends on the role. And so, you know, if I'm looking for my team, being a generalist is a little bit better because our role is customer facing, right? And so, you know, you can be working, I just remember which customers I can name and which customers I can't. So, you know, it's like you can be working, you know, with a life sciences customer. Pfizer's a good example. We talk about them publicly. So like you can be working Pfizer today and tomorrow you can be working with the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day you can be working with a giant retail customer, right? Or maybe not the next day, but the next month or, you know. So from my team, because we're customer facing and we're not at a place where I have hundreds of data scientists, so I can have 50 people who do retail and 50 people. Yeah, for me, I have to have that generalist. But if you're a data scientist, you know, in industry and you are going to work at one of those banks or at that retail place and be there for 10 or 15 years, that drive to go deeper and be a specialist, I think is helpful. I personally, and I think in general, I think data science is still varied and changing enough that like a hardcore specialist outside of academia or outside of like really proper, like real R&D data science at a tech company building algorithms or something, like that like hardcore PhD specialization where it's like laser focused, that rarely is successful to me outside of those like really, really deep ones. But again, right, the data scientist is such a like wide term today. You know, yes, there's room for people who are far more specialists than I am, and there's room for people who are generalists, but finding the right job for your tendencies is important because you don't want to be in the wrong space.
Yeah. And how do you go about structuring a team? Because I mean, did you mention you have a team of 20 people at the minute? Or
yeah, just about 20 here.
So that's like a lot of people collectively to be able to kind of manage, to be able to pull together and kind of fight the same cause, if you will. So yeah. how do you go about building that? That must be really challenging.
It's not easy. the thing that's the most important view for me in building data scientists, and this is where, like, you know, especially when I talk about this at conferences or with customers about how to build teams, is trying to break out of looking for like the unicorn mindset, right? You know, so there's the famous sort of Venn diagram of the, you know, hacking skills, whatever. And, you know, here's your picture of the unicorn in the middle. I don't need a team of 20 people that are all this perfect intersection of these skills. And especially when you're talking about in industry trying to hire for that, you know, go find the person who knows math and statistics, knows computer science well enough, and then knows enough about insurance to be a kick-ass data scientist. Like, all five people that are out there are out of your price range. So how do you build those people and build a team that is like the collection of those skills? That's where I really focus. And so, you know, I sort of look at every person on my team is going to come in with a strength somewhere. I don't hire, you know, I'm not like sort of like compared to the like full pure generalists that you would say, like the traditional management consultant that's like, ah, yes, I know a little bit about everything and a lot about nothing. Everybody in my team spikes somewhere, right? They've come from an industry and they, you know, they worked at a bank and they really know finance, or they came from academia and they really are like a hardcore statistics person or a hardcore NLP person or, but I'm always sort of looking at, back to that, how do I learn? I'm also looking at like, where's the market going? Where are customers going? What's the need on my team that, you know, like every time a question comes in, I only have one person who can answer it, or I have no people who can answer it. That's then the next skill set that I'm going to start looking for. And that just moves. And so you kind of have to constantly, and that's, you know, I'm constantly in conversation with my managers about that. Like, you know, we're just opening up a handful more positions right now. And it's not, okay, let's go find, you know, five people that have this perfect intersection. It's like, well, where are we lacking? We just brought somebody in a couple months ago who has a more proper software engineering and especially UI UX background is what she's done. And very explicitly, I was like, that's great. Because our customers often are coming to us and saying like, hey, I want to write this, you know, this front end using CSS or JavaScript or whatever. And I'm like, I got one guy in Paris that we keep tapping. We need, that's clearly a thing that we need. So we need to build that skill set out. So that in general, and you know, in practice, it's harder than it's hard to do, but that like, it's always for me is the blend of skills and saying, I have people who are more businessy. I have people who are more computery. I have people who are more mathy or however you want to put it, but I'm constantly looking at that, you know, not just in these sort of like general spikes, but you know, like where specifically from computer science, do I need somebody that's a hardcore production person? No, because I have engineers that work at my company. So when I need to talk to like hardcore ML ops, I've got engineers. So when I think about people who are better at computer science on my team, it was like the UX stuff was where I kept feeling that gap. And so we looked for somebody that had that. So that's it, at a broad stroke, how I think about it.
You make it sound probably a lot easier than it is.
Well, the upshot of that, to go back to the beginning of the conversation and my like weird path to getting here. One of the things that I learned early on in my career was managing at a Starbucks. And I had, you know, so you can think about the job of a barista at a coffee shop as a pretty homogenous job, right? You're talking to customers, you're getting pastries, you're making coffee. Man, everybody does the same thing, right? But I remember working at a store where I had a 16-year-old high school student and a 63-year-old retired marketing director,
right?
You know, like an MBA and stuff,
wow,
who knew way more about business than I did as a 20-something-year-old, you know, managing a coffee shop. And they were both baristas, but they did not do the same thing. They didn't bring the same strengths to the job. And so, you know, for me, it was a good learning in that sort of to understand, one, I have to manage them differently, right? Like, you know, how do you, you don't treat a 16-year-old woman and a 63-year-old man the same way. But also, how do I get them to do the best part of the job that they can do? And so, you know, even in something that is, and I'd say being a barista is maybe harder than it looks, but, you know, even in something as trivial as being, you know, a barista at a coffee shop, everybody brought different strengths to the team. And I was always looking to see, what do I need? Now, on the data science side, what we do is way broader. And, you know, the sort of like gulf or the you know, gaps in skill sets can become a lot bigger. But I'm still applying that exact same mindset of just like, look, of the people that I have here, what are they doing today? And then where are the gaps and how do we fill those?
Yeah, that's a brilliant analogy, actually, for your point. That makes a lot of sense. And I suppose when you're in that environment, especially working in a coffee shop with those different characters, you can actually see it happening. You can see those different personalities. You can see their skills.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, and it's funny. So learning to be a manager in retail or like restaurant is a wonderful place to do it because you get immediate feedback, right? When somebody's doing a good job, you know it 5 minutes later because a customer said so, or more often when they're doing a bad job, you know it because the customer will tell you, right? And so you get that immediate feedback, both on how the team's doing, how they're interacting, and all of that. In, you know, this world of data science, the signal's slower.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's definitely so, you know, I don't know 2 weeks in if somebody's doing a good job or not, because you can't learn to do our job in 2 weeks. You know, but what is that timeline? 3 months, 6 months, where should they be? How do they be? How do you start to pick out, like, okay, you know, this person's really good at this, this person's really good at that. Are they good enough at those things? Do I need to? And then how do you provide that scaffolding to give them those other skills, right? You know, we're all customer facing. So I spend probably more time talking to my team about developing, you know, the soft skills, the customer facing side of stuff, than I do talking about technical skills, because I hire for curiosity and I hire people who are technical. So, like, you know, they're always like, oh, let's go learn about Kubernetes. Let's go learn about how to tune Spark, or let's go learn, you know, how to use Face, or let's go, you know, so it's like that part's easy if you hire the right people.
Yeah.
For us, because we're so customer facing, it's not that I don't also obviously sort of like filter for people who can, I can put in front of a customer. But that's a skill set that we have to, I think, deliberately nurture a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting. And I've heard a lot about the philosophy, you know, through speaking to other people on the podcast, and they almost always say, you know, they, through learning, they try and be the least smart person in the room all times. And I just think it makes a lot of sense though, doesn't it? But it takes a lot of confidence to actually do that.
I read a career book years and years ago, and that was like, you know, it was supposed to be like radical careering or something like that. And I don't remember anything from it except the one sentence was be the dumbest person in the room.
Yeah.
And like, it has stuck with me my entire career, and I love it. Right. And that's, I am far more energized by having a crap ton of really smart people around me than being the smartest person in the room. When I look around at a room, and I mean, that's maybe why I don't work in coffee anymore, was, you know, it's sort of like looking around the room and I'm like, I don't know that like I'm getting driven by my peers here. Right. Versus, you know, every person, you know, my managers, every person on my team knows more about what they do on a day-to-day basis than I do. And they're all better hands-on data scientists in one way or another, or in many ways, than I am. Because that's exactly that, you know, that is a huge principle for me is, you know, I want to be the dumbest person here, and I hire people who are smarter than me every day.
Yeah. And it's amazing because, you know, as a manager, do you follow kind of the hands-off approach where you just, you know, you've hired the right people and then you let them kind of build themselves almost? I mean,
yeah, I probably default to hands-off more. You know, every person is different. And so you have to find that right balance for them. Some people need more guidance. Some people need less. Some people think one or the other and they're wrong. And so you also have to help bring them to the sort of understanding where what they really need. But yeah, that I very much agree with that philosophy of, you know, I want to bring in people that are going to be self-starters. And I'm personally more interested in saying that's where you need to go. Mm. Right. As long as I'm setting direction for them, I'm not going to chart the path for them to get there. Unless they need my help to do that. Right. So, you know, I'll give them the guidance. I'll sort of say, hey, here's our objectives for the year. And we spent time, spent time as a group in January saying, what do we want to work on this year? And then I took that all in. We distilled it down and said, all right, here's our priorities.
Cool.
Who's going to work on what? Assign it. And then, yes, I'm going to check in with you every month. I'm going to ask where you guys are at. You know, we're going to talk about specifics. I'm going to contribute to the ones where it's most important to me. But I don't want to be telling people what to do every day. There's too many of them and I don't want to do it even if, you know, there weren't.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever experienced bad management on your career?
Of course.
Isn't it bizarre that you can spot bad management immediately, but good management, it almost goes unnoticed because it's just happening without you even realizing.
Yeah. I think that you can learn as much or more from bad managers
Absolutely.
As you do from good managers. Yeah. And, you know, I think that it's obviously a spectrum, right? You know, I've had really, really bad managers, and I've had managers who were really, very rarely as a manager, in the same way that some of the other things we talk about, very rarely, man, have I talked to managers that are just bad across the board.
Yeah.
It's happened, but it's rarer, right? Mm-hmm. It's usually in the same way that, you know, talking about the skills I look for in my teams. Every manager that I've worked for has taught me something. Right?
Definitely.
And has been really good at some aspect of the job. And so that's the piece that I really sort of try to look for is like, you know, A, is this person the right manager for me? And are they the right manager for me today? Right. You know, sometimes you work for somebody that, you know, at first they're really good for you, but then as you evolve, they stay the same. And so what was really good for you for the first 6 months or a year is not down the road. And then vice versa. I've worked for people that I was just like, oh my God, like this is not going to work. And then, you know, in retrospect, in hindsight, I look back at it and I was like, wow, like we didn't get along, but they were actually a really good manager. And I learned a ton working for them, even though we didn't necessarily always get along. So, of course we all had bad managers. I try really hard to sort of like focus on like, all right, like what am I getting here? But then when do I recognize that, you know, right now they're no longer the right person for me, or, you know, I need something different. I know that there are people who've liked working for me and there are people that haven't. And so it's also hard to be the right manager for every person on your team. It's not even a skill. It's just a thing you just sort of have to learn, right? You just have to be in there and do it and figure out who's this person and how do I help them? And I still get it wrong today, right? So, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect manager.
Yeah, that's true. And it's probably worth remembering or noting that, you know, no one wants to be a bad manager. You know, they're not trying to be bad. In hindsight, you know, I've had bad managers before who I think are bad managers before. And I really, back in the day, I would have hated to have managed me. I mean, you know, when you're 21, you think like... the sun shines out your backside and you go into meetings and you're giving it all this and you think, God, I must have been really difficult to manage. So it's kind of a two-way thing, isn't it?
It is very, you know, and I in the balance, I at this point really put more of the onus on the manager to be the one figuring out how to manage the person.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it's a two-way street, right? And so it's like neither party gets to just say, this is how I am, deal with it. Again, you know, a good manager should be taking more of that, like finding them, but it's, you know, maybe not meeting halfway, but it's definitely meeting in the middle. It's a two-way street. and yeah, right. I think that sentence you said, nobody wants to be a bad manager.
Yeah,
of course not. Right. Like people may become managers for the wrong reasons.
Absolutely.
Right.
Which definitely
being a manager. And I say this to my team and I'm like, you know, every time we start talking about career stuff, I'm like, go look at my calendar. And just remember, like, if you want to be where I am today, what that looks like, right? And you can just look at my calendar that's, you know, 8-9 hours of meetings every day, right? Wow. Like, you know, back to the how much time do I spend coding or how much time do I spend building models? I can't tell you the last time that I actually built a real model for a customer. That's just not what my role is anymore. And so, you know, if you become a manager, but I love managing people. So, like, you have to become a manager for the right reasons. And that's where I think that most people who aren't good managers became a manager for the wrong reasons, for the prestige, for the status, for the pay raise, for whatever. And part of that's our fault, I think, structurally, and making it that for a lot of times to advance, the only way to advance is to become a manager, right? And, you know, in a field like data science, any technical field, engineering, actuarial science, you know, data science, all this stuff, a really good technical contributor is worth just as much or more than I am. Right? You know, properly, right? Like, you know, both financially and in every way, they are worth their weight in gold. And making it so that people have that option to say, you know what? I don't want to be a manager, because being a manager is, it sucks even when you like it, right? Or it sucks some of the time, even when you like it. And so you have to give people an option that, like, it's not the default to say, I want to advance my career, so I have to become a manager. But I really do, you know, nobody wants to be a bad manager. And I think more often than not, when somebody's not a good manager, it's mostly because they did it for the wrong reasons than that that they're like, ah, you know what I want to be is a petty tyrant who ruins people's lives. Like, nobody comes into it with that, you know, opinion.
Very true. Yeah. And
or maybe some. Maybe there's a few sociopaths out there, right? So
I think I've met a few of them.
Never say none, but it's not the default.
Yeah. And we're getting into the big questions here now, Connor. Do you think good management or management in general is learned or innate?
I think it's learned. I really do. I think... you know, of course, people have, you know, maybe some people have like a more natural tendency for it or they learn it faster. But I really think that it's learned because you can't, again, you can't learn what it looks like to support somebody, what it looks like to, you know, have those career conversations or how to correct somebody's behavior. Nobody knows how to give correcting feedback to somebody who's underperforming. Out of the womb, right? Like that you just like some people are maybe nicer about it or more blunt about it. Everybody has their own style innately, but you have to learn like when and how and, you know, what's the right way to do that. So, you know, again, maybe there's people who are like maybe slightly more naturally suited to it, but I firmly believe that it's a learned thing.
It's so interesting. It's like when you think about a manager, you kind of almost just think, you know, managing a team, making things happen, getting the ball rolling, you know, pulling people together. But there's also like tiny things on a day to day that like line managers have to deal with. Like you're mentioning there, delivering kind of almost like negative feedback. It's like you have to be so empathetic and you have to have a really good bedside manner. And, you know, even there's like the small frictions between people, and it's all also as well as motivating people, different individuals. And it's just like, is it the bigger the team gets, the more challenging that becomes? I mean, to an extent, I mean, from say managing a team of 10 to 30, does it make it hugely different?
I think the big difference when you start to scale like that is when you go from managing individuals to managing managers.
Right.
Because that's really different. And still something that I'm figuring out, right? Because, you know, it's if I'm spending time with the team and I understand their motivations and I can understand, you know, like, how do I give this person feedback? You know, how do I see what they're doing? If I'm spending time with somebody, I've learned to do that. But how do you teach somebody how to do that?
Which is
what, when you're managing managers, you have to do. So I do think it gets hard as you scale, not because it's just that there's more people, but because it's not my job to sit with every data scientist on my team and understand how they're going, give them corrective feedback, give them career advice. I'm there to support all of those things, of course, right? But, you know, when somebody's having someone's having a challenge, I can't go over my manager and override them and just deal with it. Or every once in a while you do have to, right? So to be fair, right? There's always these situations, but it's the balance of like, how much time do I spend with the manager? How much time do I spend with the person? So it gets harder, but it's not just a pure scale. I think it's just the remove, right? And, you know, for me personally, I look at, you know, like former colleagues or friends of mine who are, you know, COOs or CIOs managing hundreds of people. I have no idea how, like at that sort of scale, when you're 5, 6, 7 layers removed from your frontline workers, what does it take to be effective at that level? Because that's that sort of like every level of management is a different skill set. I think line managers is one of the most crucial to be brutally honest, right? Like that, like frontline manager in every organization that I've ever worked at is oftentimes more important than these people a few layers up in terms of like the impact, because they're the ones dealing with people, dealing with a customer, dealing with your, you know, like, so how effectively they do their job is really, really important. And the objective of the people above them, the higher you go, your job is to just enable, right? Like, and how do you give them direction and help them be successful? It's a different skill set to learn, certainly at every single layer. And I think, you know, the layer that I'm at now, I think I know what I'm doing. I think I'm okay at it. But that next layer up, I don't know what, you know, I don't know if that's a skill set that I have yet. And I don't know what that will look like if and when I get there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Connor, we could literally sit here and chat all day. We
probably could.
We literally could. It feels like we're just scraping the surface with these massive issues and topics. But I wanna get one more question out of you, if you're all right with
Shoot.
That.
Of course.
Okay, then. So if you want to think back to the start of your career, if you could go back in time to that, to when you were starting out, is there anything you'd do differently if you had the second, if you had a second chance?
So look, I dropped out of college when I was 18, and it's hard not to look back at that choice and not have regrets, right?
Right.
Because, you know, going to school when you're 26, 27, married with two kids, working full time and everything is not the most fertile learning ground, right? And my college experience was not the typical, you know, sort of path through university that people have. And so it's hard for me not to look back at that sort of decision when I, you know, sort of failed out of college at 18 as being pretty big fuck up, bluntly, right? Like, and, you know, could I go back and fix that? But, you know, I learned so much from the choices that I made. That, you know, that time that I spent as an enlisted person in the military, that time that I spent, you know, honestly, like going to school full time, working full time, being in the National Guard, raising a couple of kids, you know, I did 7 days a week for 3 years straight. I was at one or the other.
Wow.
And like, it's one of the most formative experiences in my life. Would I recommend that to anybody? No. don't do that on purpose. Let me put it that way. But, you know, like, that shaped so much who I am today that I can't really, there's no one point that I would really, if I'd go back and say, you know what, I wish I'd done that differently. It's hard not to say that like dropping out of college when you're 18 is not a, you know, of course it's a dumb idea. Don't do that if you can, but I also shouldn't have gone to school at 18. If I would have done something different, that's actually probably, it wouldn't have been dropping out of school. It would have been not going when I was 18 because I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so there, that's the one. If I could do anything different, you know, and so it's, I guess, even sort of pre-career, but like, I would have done, I don't know what I would have done. I maybe would have joined the military at 18, right? Instead of 23. That would be the thing that, you know, if I changed anything, it would have been trying to do that. The second piece that I'll say to this, that it was less of any specific decision because I've made good career calls and I made bad career calls, right? Like, you know, I turned down a job to do math research with the atomic clock team with the Department of the Navy, which is still,
wow,
maybe, right? Like I turned down that job because it was, you know, there was family reasons and, you know, it's government salary, which is, well, yeah, like there was challenges for that to become an actuary. And I hated being an actuary, right? It was a terrible career for me. It was not the right step. But that was what landed me at the company that got me into data science that has put me to where I am today. And so like, you know, yeah. Do I look at that decision and sort of go like, I still don't know. You know, it's fun to play what if, but like, you know, would I be the VP of data science at a tech company today with like all the wonderful opportunities that I've had without having made that decision? No. And so that sort of like just being open to the decision and opening and saying like, look, I don't know what I'm going to do 5 years from now. I don't know what I'm going to do 10 years from now. Right now I'm doing what I should be doing. And like, that was a good learning for me, was that sort of like, I'm not going to join a company now and say, this is what I'm going to do for the next 40 years. Cause I know that enough about myself to know that that's not going to be me. I wish I'd known that when I was 20 or 25, trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Finally, you know, sometime in my 30s, I was sort of like, oh, that's not a thing, right? I'm never going to know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
100%.
I know I'm good with what I'm doing now. And what I'm doing now isn't closing future options for me. That's sort of like, those are the pieces that I learned. There's decisions that I can second guess. And there's decisions that, you know, certainly like going to college at 18, maybe I would have done that differently, but like what I wouldn't have learned or had some of the formative experiences that I did have that have made me successful, you know,
exactly.
despite the, you know, you could, I mean, I got my bachelor's at 30, but you know, in the 10, 12 years since then, I've done all right. So like, you know, it didn't in the long run, maybe like I took a weird path to get there, but in the long run, you know, I'm happy with the decisions that I've made.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, as soon as anything gets philosophical on this podcast, I just go completely off on one, and no one wants to hear that. You know, I could talk about serendipity and life choices, and but I can't possibly. I mean, I think
I think the most important part for me has just been, and we sort of like to embody this in the sort of like lean stuff of like fail fast, right? I think the fail fast idea, the lean idea is great, but really what it comes down to me is, are you learning from the choices that you made? And nobody makes a perfect choice every time, right? Like, no, it's like literally impossible, right? Like, you don't always make the right choices. Rarely do you have these like gigantic bifurcations where your life is going to go one way or the other, but every day you have those chances to make those choices, and you're going to make a wrong choice. Mm-hmm. And rather than agonizing for months up front, just make a decision and prepare yourself to learn quickly if it was the right decision or the wrong decision. And when it was the wrong decision, what do you learn from that? And where do you go? That's the stuff that I think is far more important than, definitely, you know, did you go to the right university? Did you get that right first job? Did you do it? Like, there is no right. There is no like one path. There's lots of paths. There's lots of potential decisions. And sometimes you will make the wrong choice. But again, becoming an actuary, being an actuary, wrong choice. The company that ended up at, the situation that I ended up in, you know, I got the chance to build a data science platform and build a data science team, and has absolutely changed the trajectory of my life because I made that decision. Being an actuary, bad idea. What did I learn from it? I learned I was at a good company that would really give me other opportunities, and I took advantage of it. And I don't regret, you know, I don't regret that decision, even though knowing it was the wrong decision.
Incredibly wise words there, Connor. It is amazing to retrospectively look back at your career, and it's quite a bizarre thing to do, isn't it, really? But I think, you know, you're a very busy man with a very busy lifestyle, and you must have a whole day full of meetings, so I've got to let you go. But
unfortunately.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah.
You're an incredibly interesting and charismatic chap, so.
Well, no, thanks for the opportunity, Ben. And likewise, it's been an easy conversation to have and a lot of fun. So thank you for the opportunity. It's been my pleasure. Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.